Good morning and welcome, everyone, to Live Dharma Sunday for August 24th, 2014. Koyo Kubose here. So very glad you joined us. Oh, boy, oh, boy. This morning, as I do every morning, I'm puttering around in the kitchen, and outside our kitchen window, we have three hummingbird feeders. We must have hundreds of hummingbirds around here. There's a formula on one of the bottles that tells you how to estimate how many birds you have. I don't recall the exact formula, but if you see so many coming in a certain amount of time, then the estimate is the total number of birds is such and such. One feeder has eight portals. Another one has another eight. And then we have another one that has three. So almost 20 birds could feed simultaneously. And we put sugar water into the feeders. And when we first moved here, there must have been feeders there because we didn't know it at the time, but there was a nail under the eave of the roof eave in front of the kitchen window. There was a nail up there, and that's where the feeder must have been hung. But we didn't know this at the time, and when I was out in the back, a hummingbird came and about several feet in front of my face and was looking around. And I said, "Hey, ooh." He said, "Hey, come on, get with the program, man. Where's their feeder?" And even though the house had been vacant maybe at least a year, maybe more, but they knew where their feeder used to be. So once we hung up one, boy, they started coming. Then we added another one. Visitors came and they saw the hummingbirds, and then we got a couple of feeders as gifts, and now we're really on the schedule. And I have to fill these things up almost every day, for sure every other day. And we got a book on hummingbirds. When you see them every day, you start to notice more and more, and you see things that do not happen that frequently, but they do happen. And there's a lot of trees and bushes in our backyard, so you know, I think that's important. That's where they nest and hang out. Then they come to the feeder, and then they go back to the bushes. And we would not have so many if there was not a lot of vegetation and trees around. They're very territorial and competitive in their feeding. There's a pecking order. All the males are very brightly colored, and hummingbirds have iridescent feathers. When they go into the sunlight, it just flashes with at first you notice all the competitiveness. Then you see that some of them are buddies. They must be able to recognize, of course, each other right away, even though a lot of them look alike to us. But the buddies, or maybe they're couples, they'll feed out of the same little hole right next to each other, taking turns or sometimes putting their beaks in at the same time into that little hole, into the single hole feeder. Other times, once in a while, we will find a dead one. Don't know why. One time, they do a lot of aerial battles where they're posturing and they're chasing and each other around. Time we found two birds on the ground, and one's beak You know, they have a long, sharp, narrow beak, was pierced right through the chest of another hummingbird. When we separated them, the one who had pierced the other one in the chest flew away, but the pierced one was deceased. I saw someone sent us a picture they saw in a bird magazine of a praying mantis that staked out himself on a feeder, and he had caught a hummingbird. Oh, wow, that was some picture. But we see all kinds of activity. They're always around, and I learn a lot from them about nature, about they create fairyland, make it magical. Tired of seeing all these hummingbirds around. So I'm just sharing with you a little bit our local scene here. I want to move on to introducing today's Dharma Glimpse, our guest. Her name is Michelle Joyle. She lives in Deland, Florida. And she was part of our latest lay ministry graduating class, LM6. Her Dharma name of Joyal, it means solid sun. And of course, the word solid could mean a lot of things, and we always encourage people to use their Dharma name to renew, to inspire, to get teachings from. And she is the wife of Morris Sekiel, and he is the current Trailblazer president. Trailblazer Group is the resource group for the Bright Dawn Center's lay ministry program. And it's awfully nice when you get a husband-wife team. It's a real contribution. They work together. So, without further ado, let me introduce Michelle Joyle for today's Dharma Glimpse.
You know, when Adrian first asked me to do the Dharma Glimpse today, I jumped at the chance. Putting one of these together, for me, has been a nice mindfulness practice. However, I do have a tendency to fall prey to one of the more pernicious aspects of harmful speech, self-criticism. Right speech is what we strive for. When we talk about harmful speech, we often reference false, harsh, and idle speech. And when we think of harsh speech, we think of gossip or maligning other people or, my personal favorite, swearing like a sailor. But we tend to forget that the way we talk to and about ourselves should fall in the same category. For example, I would have a bunch of thoughts written out and decide not a single one of them were interesting enough to talk about. I would immediately discount ideas as unoriginal or foolish. I'd put off coming up with something to say over and over again because I tell myself that I just wasn't good at this kind of thing. Does any of this sound familiar? I'm betting it does. How many times have you told yourself that you're not good at something, or you're too stupid to learn something, or you can't do something because you're uncoordinated, or too tall, too short, too old, too young, too fat, too thin? How often has this criticism prevented you from doing something that you really wanted to do? Harmful speech is harmful to us and to others, even when it's directed inward. When you spend your time criticizing yourself, it warps your views of the world. At times it can be so bad that it doesn't allow you to relax around others or to truly enjoy things. Well, this all comes down to one thing, compassion. It seems that we have a much easier time being understanding of and compassionate toward others than toward ourselves. It's true that we're our own worst critics. We've become very adept at it. Where we're lacking is in showing ourselves the same compassion that we afford others. You know, this human life, provides enough opportunity for us to suffer without us compounding the problem by making ourselves miserable. I'm not saying it'll be easy, but do try to show yourself some compassion. Be accepting of yourself as a human being with all the flaws that come along with that. There's a line from one of my favorite movies that I think sums up this idea fairly nicely. The movie is Mary and Max, and in the scene, Max is writing a letter to Mary, and I'm paraphrasing, but it goes, "You are imperfect, and so am I. All humans are imperfect. When I was young, I wanted to be anybody but myself. If I was on a desert island, then I would have to get used to my own company, just me and the coconuts. I would have to accept myself, my warts and all. Everyone's lives are like a very long sidewalk. Some are well paved. Others, like mine, have cracks, banana skins, and cigarette butts." So you see, we all have flaws. We are not perfect, and that's okay. But we can take that self-criticism and turn it into self-acceptance. We all have Buddha nature. For some of us, the journey to finding that Buddha nature might be a bit longer. Our path might not be as easy, but even a cracked sidewalk will eventually take you where you want to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I like that phrase, turning self-criticism into self-acceptance. If we use the word acceptance, that's really a key aspect in spiritual growth. Somehow, we can learn a lot from the attitude, our self-concept, attitudes toward ourselves. Sometimes we're too boastful, and sometimes we're too self-critical. So those are gateways in which we can go beyond the dualism of superiority or inferiority complexes. This is a good theme or topic. And our self-talk that we do to each, to ourselves can be, we could challenge sometime our negative self-talk. Or self-talk could be a very positive source of reminders about our spirituality. When we think about right speech, it's a really big topic and an important one because the way we interact with others really is colored by how we communicate to them. Of course, nonverbal communication is important too, but how we talk, what we say, how we say it, is a tremendous thing, okay? In our everyday activities and everyday spirituality, it's right speech goes beyond more than just not lying, being truthful, not saying harmful things. Not saying harmful things. This means silence is also part of right speech. Silence is golden. And on this theme, when I heard, you know, the theme of right speech, we have a Dharma friend who lives in Oregon, and he emailed me about a month ago, shared with me his blog, I guess you might call it, and called Right Speech. And I was really, I thought it was a great Dharma glimpse, really. And we're going to probably try to put this into the next newsletter and so forth, but I'm looking at his write-up on right speech. to share it with you, just sort of paraphrasing from it. But he starts off with, you know, 9/11 sometimes can be seen as very similar to Pearl Harbor. Both were surprise attacks and tremendous loss of life. And December 7th, 1941, we entered World War II, and it was certainly a defining moment of the 20th century. He says, a few weeks ago, I was going through some family papers and came across a resume for my late father. He was a civil engineer, and I noticed that from October 1940 to December 1941, he worked in the survey office, Pearl Harbor Navy Yard. He was the chief of engineer for surveys on channel soundings, buildings, and pipelines. The next month, he changed jobs, and from January 42 to February 43, he worked in the U.S. Engineer's office in Honolulu as the chief of party on surveys for highway constructions, utilities, designs, and surveys for highways. In the decades and all my life when I knew my dad, he never once said he was at Pearl Harbor. I knew he worked in Honolulu, and I had a vague idea he had a job there, you know, from a long time ago. But I never knew. Plus, I never heard my dad say one negative thing about the Japanese. He was an avid gardener, and he had a lot of joy in his life going to Japanese-American nurseries that were common where we grew up in Southern California. Still, the question remains, why didn't he mention being at Pearl Harbor? Some might say it was his generation. They didn't talk about war. But I think right speech, in this case silence, might explain my father's letting Pearl Harbor rest in the past. You know, if American involvement in World War II began with Pearl Harbor, it also ended with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we think about the impact of those two A-bombs, you know, and the horribleness of war. And we might understand why the madness of war would lead that to silence. Yes, I think my father's silence about Pearl Harbor was for the best. To let me grow up in a post-war world without the burden of easy racism. And in fact, when I visited Japan a few years ago, I visited Nagoya Jo, the reconstructed castle in Nagoya. And they had a plaque there, and you know, a lot of places in Japan they commemorate, not I don't know commemorate, but they show a certain kind of attitude. The plaque at that reconstructed castle said, because of world hostilities, the earlier castle burned down in 1945. There was no naming names, no assignment of blame. These very understated, almost laconic words would fit in right with what his job was, surveys for runway reconstruction. What a nice sharing. And this is what I love about Bright Dawn Center, all the extended Sangha members and Dharma friends we have. And I get to share things that come into our office. How wonderful, how wonderful. That's all for today's broadcast. Until next time, you keep going and you have a very beautiful Sunday. Thank you.